Hello and welcome to another episode of Mere Fidelity, where we have conversations about life and the church's life in the world, and how do we remain faithful in the culture and context we find ourselves in. Today I'm joined by Alistair Roberts and not Andrew Wilson. Andrew Wilson is gone today, but Matt Lee Anderson is here, and so the three of us are going to take up the issue of shaming, or rather public shaming. Recently there was an article in the New York Times, how one stupid tweet blew up Justine Sacco's life. And it just tells a story that, you know, it could be Justine or it could be someone else, but it's so familiar. Justine Sacco, she was a PR rep, very small Twitter following. She's going on a trip right before she gets on the plane. She tweets out just a stupid tweet that she thought would be ironic and so forth. You know, said going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, oh wait, I'm white, I won't, or something like that. And that got retweeted thousands upon thousands of times, such that by the time she got off the plane, millions upon millions had seen the tweet. There was angry letters, angry, you know, just kind of the social media mob pounced, and she ended up losing her job, publicly shamed, and the article kind of chronicles how she has dealt with life after these kinds of social media, this kind of social media instance, and it talks about other instances of public shaming, just kind of analyzing the phenomenon that if you're on the internet, you've seen at one point or another, maybe you've been a part of at one point or another. So we just wanted to take that up today. We're not talking about the general topic of shame. We're going to take that up in the future, but just the practice of public shaming, especially in an internet age. So with that, we wanted to just dissect that, and we're going to have Alistair head up first with a comment. So Alistair, you got any thoughts on this?
Yes, I think one of the things that first strikes me about these situations is that they owe a lot to the culture of the internet. The internet strikes me as a very boring place much of the time, inherently boring. And we try and mitigate that boredom by setting up these cycles of outrage and other things like that. And this gives excitement for a period of time until it dies down, and then the next thing starts up again. And we feel engaged, we feel connected with what's going on, we feel that we're doing our part for justice, whatever it is. And I don't see why anyone would care what Justine Sacco believes or holds to, were it not for the internet. She's a fairly unknown figure. And the only reason why we care is because Twitter tells us that we ought to care that some person many, many miles away who has no connection with our lives holds some unreconstructed opinion. So I think in discussing this, we have to have a discussion of internet culture and how the internet raises these cycles to a level that they would not have occurred on previously.
Can I ask about that, Alistair? Because I think it's counterintuitive to most of us. It's certainly counterintuitive to me to think about the internet as inherently boring. Can you just unpack for me what you mean by that? Because it seems like we turn to the internet precisely for a kind of stimulation, precisely for a kind of entertainment to sort of end our own boredom, which we feel internally. But that means that I think we conceive of the internet as not an inherently boring place, as a place that's very exciting, where lots of things are going on that we can participate in. So can you just say a little bit more about what you mean by the internet being inherently boring?
Yes, definitely. I think that the internet is boring, maybe not in the sense that we usually think, but leads to a sort of automation of human activity, that we're just mindlessly clicking through certain things from article to article, or playing some game, or interacting on Facebook or Twitter. But there's less of a sense of engagement than we'd naturally have in our day-to-day lives. It's a way of dealing with boredom without actually... It's dealing with boredom without being engaged, truly. It's a way of automating our human activities. So, for instance, a game that you play can be very repetitive, and it staves off boredom, it fills the time, but it doesn't actually engage you in the way that a normal human activity would, let's say cooking or creating something, or going out for a knitting. Walk, seeing nature, these sorts of things. It's a way of dealing with boredom that doesn't actually get at the root of it, but just gets us into a sort of false state of flow that leaves us in this sort of state of boredom that isn't actually uprooted. It's just we don't have a sense of it so much.
It's covered over.
We've just palliated our sense of boredom without actually dealing with the root state.
Well, and it generates certain kinds of conversations that's the thing. We turn these things into basically angry conversation pieces. You know, there was a silly I don't know clickhole piece a while back about Shark Week and the fact that people get really excited about Shark Week, and you know the last one is ironically, okay, I'm sorry, I don't really have that much that I'm into, but Shark Week gives me something to talk about, so I'm going to be really excited about Shark Week. And so it was really funny because Shark Week people amuse me, but these kinds of things, it is a form of entertainment, and it's a conversation starter for a lot of people who are on the internet who like getting in these kinds of quote unquote conversations, which really oftentimes are just kind of mockery and outrage fests. So there's this element of, hey, we have a reason to be tweeting at each other about things. And I don't know, that I think that's got to be at least part of the social dimension to this.
But it's a conversation as a form of entertainment, but with a deeply moral edge.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like what's unique about this kind of shaming that goes on is it allows for a genuine, like, vindictiveness. There is a sense of vengeance, it seems to me, that stands beneath those who participate in this kind of shaming, and it seems to me like it's trying to fill up a lack of a sort of robust moral framework that we have that's shared.
Yeah.
And to, in one sense, like, scapegoat certain people who violate norms.
Oh, yeah. This is scapegoating.
In the most vicious of ways, because we don't have a collective moral framework for acknowledging the wrongness of things. And so it becomes the only way in which we can generate that is through this kind of shouting match and through this sort of extreme shaming that goes on. So it seems like, you know, it is a form of entertainment, but it's a form of entertainment that seems motivated in part by moral concerns, even if we would never necessarily describe them as moral concerns.
Well, and on that point,
I think on that front, it's worth...
Oh, go. Well, I was going to say there's two really quick... go for it.
Go on, Derek.
Go for it.
All right. I think on that front, it's worth remembering that that you talk about this as a moral concern, and I think that's right. But it's not just about... We talk about social justice warriors who want to call out certain people to challenge their injustice in their speech, whatever it is. But it's not just about that moral dimension. It's also about signaling to one another our being on the right side of history or on the moral issues, that we hold the proper position. And I think that's a lot of what's going on in many of these cases. Many of these contexts where people are talking are extreme echo chambers. The people that they're protesting about aren't actually listening in or caring about the conversation. Rather, the protest and the outrage is for the sake of signaling to one another that they hold the right beliefs. And a lot of the policing takes place not upon those who are outside, but upon those who are closely related to the group. So it's the people who are connected in some sense, who other people on the left, particularly, for instance, will find themselves subject to this policing. those outside of the left, they won't experience it so much.
Well, there's that element of, I mean, I think of Jonathan Haidt and that element of that when he talks in the Righteous Mind, kind of the PR dimension of our social interactions, the constant public presentation of righteousness, that is definitely there's that pressure, you know, when some event happens that, oh shoot, I've got to weigh in, I've got to show that I'm holding the right opinion, and it's something completely extraneous to your own life. You're not even at six levels removed. You're you know 100 levels removed from any situation, but are you on the right side of this one? The two thoughts that came to my mind when I was thinking about it was one, Matt, the scapegoating bit. You know, I usually make fun of Girardian takes on atonement or things like that, but here in a situation like this, Rene Girard's scapegoating analysis actually can come in and do some really interesting work. The other thing that I kind of wonder is how many of these shaming interactions or campaigns are generated by people who in other situations and contexts do not feel like they can have that sort of power or authority or kind of social leverage to, I don't know, take on what they see to be perceived injustice, and sometimes really are real injustices. But I wonder if there's like an inverse relationship between how effective or how much of a voice you feel you have in your offline life and how particularly important online your online voice becomes or your online activities to expose or shame or whatever it is. Just thinking about the dynamics of the way this swirls out of control and the way these crowds, kind of, you know, RT mobs, retweet mobs, kind of function and operate. That's interesting to me, kind of beneath the roots there. Matt or Alistair, you got a thought on that?
Yeah, so I mean, one on this signaling stuff, because I think it's really interesting and really important. It happens not just in. I think it's really important to say it happens not just in shaming type context or in social justice type context. I even think about things like the 21 Christians in Egypt who were beheaded.
Oh yeah,
right. That instantly creates a context online where all the Christians have to signal to each other our outrage and our support of fellow Christians. And if you don't, there's a kind of tacit pressure to say something about that, such that if you don't, it feels ambiguous. Like, it feels like other people are going to think that your position on that is ambiguous. And that happens in any kind of sort of public seasons of public unrest. So in Ferguson, you had to say something about it so that everyone knew where you fell. And I actually, for what it's worth, I actually take a deliberately refuse to publicly display my thoughts or my feelings about those kinds of things in the middle of when everyone else is, in part because that kind of signaling strikes me as deeply problematic in a lot of ways, and you see the negative effects of it in when it goes bad in these kinds of shaming contexts. But what the shamers do in with respect to signaling is something that we are all complicit in. It's something that we all do, and that troubles me.
What would you guys say? Any kind of, because we're all kind of talking clearly. Oh, this is negative. Justine's life was ruined, and many other people's lives have been ruined. But in terms of possibly positive dimension to these, you know, this kind of public shaming activity, I mean, it's not just all social posturing or yeah, making up for lacks in their own personal lives or whatever it is. I mean, what are the positive reasons given for certain campaigns to raise awareness and, you know, in these ways? I mean, what would you guys say about that? I'm curious. Kind of give the other
one of the fundamental impetuses for all of this is the recognition that discourse is not just about truth, it's also about power. I mean, I think that's taken to an extreme within these contexts where discourse becomes about power rather than truth. But there's the recognition of the imbalances of power within a particular conversation. The difference between your voice and my voice, the way that my privilege, the fact that I have a particular background, I have a particular education, all these sorts of things, gives my voice more weight and enables your voice to be dismissed. So that's one of the things that's driving many of these debates, the concern to recover and protect the voices of those who would otherwise be marginalized or dismissed from the conversation in some way. And often this can be pushing back against sometimes a discourse of civility. Now, civility is a form of discourse, control upon discourse, that can often silence the voices of those who are oppressed, who are marginalized in various ways, because you can't express anger or protest within the conversation because it's not civil. And the language of political correctness, these sorts of things, is often an alternative to that, a means of policing discourse so that the voices that would otherwise be held out on the basis of civility can be heard, and their protests set the tone for the conversation.
Yeah. Okay. So that all makes sense to me, and I can buy all that. Maybe I just think that there are slightly different things going on with the kind of shaming that Justine Sacco experienced. Because she said something that was dumb and a bad thing to say. But one of the interesting threads about all the people who have experienced this kind of shaming as individuals is that they said things in public that for them had a broader narrative context. They had... sort of a meaning for them, which depended upon things that they had done previously. And what happens is the one thing that they say that people discover gets disconnected from that narrative context. And they become pariahs on the basis of it, when for them it actually meant something really different. And it seems like what goes on in these sorts of shaming rituals is, for the ancients, mercy is a quality of seeing the particular context in which wrongs were done and having a kind of leniency of within our punishment towards those individuals, not because we're excusing it necessarily, at all, but because we're seeing the particular things that drove them to that and framing what they did in a much broader context. And I think it's really disturbing to me that that kind of mercy seems to be absent, where we literally do not want to put what people say in a broader narrative context to try to understand it as they themselves understand it.
Yeah.
So even while I get the good reasons for this, to me it seems like a really worrying trend.
No, yeah. I wanted to just put that into place, because otherwise it just seems like, all right, they're just random attacks. Some people actually think that they are accomplishing something, but yeah, the astonishing lack of mercy, great talk of grace becomes problematic in these situations, because it's inherently assumed by many, okay, this is going to be a grace that's used to cover over or silence real criticism that ought to be brought against oppressors who hide behind, grace, who hide behind things like that and get excused. And that can be true. There are abusive situations where some will just actually hide behind these kinds of concerns and get away with real harms. But that even that instinct is so subject to criticism and suspicion is got to be damaging for Christian speech, because we by nature, by instinct now, by Christian instinct, by spiritual instinct, should be given to mercy. We should have grace instincts, even as we hold up very strong justice components to our speech. And so there's that really strong element of condemning what is wrong and at the same time giving grace for the sinner. And I think that is rendered very problematic in some of these shaming contexts. Once you've been identified with one phrase or one tweet or one statement as taking any kind of privileged or oppressor role, even if it's a stray offhand comment, you are outside the bounds of mercy. And this is where some of the scapegoating Girardian dynamic kind of comes in for us as kind of a collective culture. Alistair?
I think there are a number of factors here to what Matt was saying. First of all, there's when we've connected discourse to power rather than truth, the hermeneutics of suspicion will kick in. Every discourse that disagrees with us will be presumed to be an attempt to dissemble a power claim, some means of oppressing others, some means of securing privilege. Then there's also the fact that the internet decontextualizes discourse. Twitter doesn't allow for context very well. Other things online are quoted, thrown around outside of their original context. We don't have thick context now in the way that we would have had 10, 20 years ago. I think also there's the fact that a lot of people are not good at reading context. So this is one thing I've noticed on a number of occasions in the past. There's a sort of lack of literacy, just the ability to read an argument, where people will be triggered by a particular expression, a turn of phrase, a metaphor, whatever it is, and they'll react to that without actually thinking, how does this function within the larger argument? Are they actually trying to say something offensive here? Or is this just an almost instinctive emotional reaction to something that was said in maybe the most an infelicitous manner? Then there's also the issue of who you are. When you're talking about the scapegoat, any pretext for attacking the scapegoat will be snatched upon. But the pretext is a pretext. It's not the actual reason. And often I think we mistake the reasons that people say that they are challenging us for actual reasons rather than what they actually are, which is often pretexts, that we are the wrong sort of people. We do not agree with the prevailing orthodoxy. We hold certain stances or align ourselves with certain people that we shouldn't. And for that reason, anything that we say will be approached with extreme suspicion. And as a result, we can face accusations that we would not do were we someone else who said these things. That's one of the things that Jonathan Chait brings up in his article that I think is important, that often this is so person-dependent that if you are a particular sort of person saying something, it will all be interpreted against you. Whereas if you were someone different, you would be given a far more merciful reading.
Yeah.
Or charitable reading.
Right, but Alistair, so Alistair, to one of your points, we actually do have thick context like we had 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's just that people ignore them, right? If someone retweets a tweet that I write, and that tweet happened to be one in a number of tweets, that tweet has been ripped from its context, but the narrative context is still there, right? And people can still go look at it. So it shifts the burden a little bit, maybe?
Perhaps. But on the other hand, I think it's important to recognize that the medium is militating against context. Twitter is not context friendly. Whereas if you're reading a book and it were a quote in the middle of a book, that is context friendly. You usually will be expected to wade through the whole thing first.
This is why your linked quotes always have those arrows at the front and the behind of every kind of middle bracketed lengthy tweet, so that they couldn't possibly be mistaken for a single standalone tweet. I now see your tricks, Alistair. I see what's going on here.
Right. So the medium pushes against it, but it's still possible, right? And it raises a question about whether it's incumbent when people say things that we deeply disagree with or find deeply objectionable to go and put that in the broader context of everything that person has said, which is accessible prior to casting judgment, right?
Yeah.
If someone retweets a tweet that I send out and they think, good God, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, which is in fact every tweet that gets retweeted from me, I'm sure. But if they think that, it may be the case that it's on them to go look at the surrounding context from what I've said and see whether there's more to it before they decide to blow me up about it.
Right, and this is...
And I just think that's part of being a good citizen of an online world, is not making judgments in decontextualized ways, because that's just a bad form of judgment, even if the medium allows it.
Yeah, well, and these are the intellectual virtues that are generally not well practiced. Taking the time to understand your opponent's reasons, taking the time to understand their actual arguments, not simply what you have heard their arguments to be, to reread an article more or reread the whole article before commenting. I don't know how many times last week alone I shared an article that I wrote, and I mean, within instance, just because of the title or the pull quote or whatever, you've got a number of comments to which my only response could be, did you read the whole article? And then from there, silence. Because clearly they didn't. Because clearly they were just reacting to a particular poll quote, to a particular title. And this is how reading on the internet happens. Not even just the internet. I do not even think some of these intellectual virtues are taught well in basic school. You know, in our literature classes, how to read a book, how to read an argument properly. Some classes, yes, but oftentimes,
right. So
it's basic reading within the reading, yes, as a Christian, read as you'd like to be read.
One thing I've commented on a number of occasions in the past is the way in which the internet establishes a certain form of social context. And much of our reading occurs within this social context now. So instead of going away to a private space and reading in isolation from other people and forming our own opinions and then arriving at a response, we are constantly being pressed for a reaction. So we have this initial exposure to a particular article within the context of a social media site, Facebook, Twitter, whatever it is. And then we're expected to have a quick reaction. And also, it's placed within the context of certain human herd dynamics. So you see all the people liking it or retweeting or opposing it,
yeah,
expressing their outrage. And this is where, again, Girard can be helpful, because Girard talks about the power of the first stone that's cast, because that sets a model for everything else. And on the internet, you see these things sort of taking place in a similar way. There's a firestorm of outrage, and once it's got going, it's very hard to stop, and it's self-perpetuating. Everyone just follows this dynamic, because it's very difficult when you have a context of reaction and rapid response. Twitter moves extremely quickly, and so if you don't have an immediate reaction, you can be left out, because there's no time for thoughtful response.
Nobody wants to reconsider their rage at any given moment, because if all of a sudden that secondary, exculpating tweet or the prior one that sets the context emerges, there is this, oh, this reverse shame that people want to avoid. You know, in some cases, there is not this context. Person is just a dip. But that element of I don't want to have been wrong in my rash reaction, so I will double down. I will ignore. I will not continue to dig at the situation to try and understand it. That happens in a number of places. And so even when you try and point out, so when you see somebody in a rage or on a tear on something like that, and you, even when you know that that's not fully the situation, many times I will simply not engage. I'll say, you know what? It's not worth it. That person will not hear. And it's not just that I'll be wrong. It's that I will be aiding an oppressor or something like that, when in fact it's not, almost not worth the time. And so there's the built-in element of even arguing against the mob will make you a victim of the mob very quickly, even if you have the evidence on your side in certain cases, when you have some of those contextual tweets that are ripped. And so it really just, yeah, it gets ugly very quickly, and there's very little, I don't know, instinct or impetus to counteract it once it's gotten going.
So I think one thing that's interesting is none of us are being hurt in any way by any of this, right? Like, I have never, people, you know, if they want to say mean things to me, that's fine. Like, my life's going to go on. I'm going to be all right. What's really interesting about Justine Sacco's situation and some of these other situations is when the shaming goes nuclear, right? And that's always a possibility. It's now a possibility which we all live under. That our missteps can become not just public and visible, but can become public and visible to the whole world in a way that that changes everything for us. So I think about Kony 2012, the social media campaign which Invisible Children did for their movie. And, you know, at the time it was regarded as the most viral video that had ever been made. It was just astonishing. And the mental effect that had on one of the leaders of Invisible Children, I mean, he had a mental breakdown because he spent a week in a global spotlight and was subjected to all sorts of vicious criticisms for the film, some of them merited. But that kind of global publicity takes problems which I just observe and do not experience, and makes them nuclear in a way that itself has a kind of muting effect on the rest of us, because we always have to walk in fear of the bomb going off and of doing something which would entail that we all become Justine Sacco. And that kind of effect is really interesting. And it's something that I think we have to proactively work against and overcome. And we have to ourselves reach a point where we're okay saying wrong things on the internet, even if other people are not going to be okay with that. Otherwise, the whole business is going to become so moribund and so so not enjoyable that it's just not going to be worth saying anything ever online at all.
Yeah, that fear,
I quite agree with that.
Is that fear? It is interesting in that even things that I get scared when a tweet gets too popular sometimes. Occasionally, we're like, I didn't anticipate that getting that much attention. I would have been more careful with it or something like that. There's like that background fear of, oh my gosh, what if the wrong person retweets it? or links it with a nasty pull quote that sets a terrible context. The thing that was interesting is how, I don't know if this is Jesus jukey, but really this kind of fear of our words being exposed at any moment is really ironic, because we are all actually supposed to be speaking as if we're going to give an account for every word we utter to someone who is of much greater authority and whose eyes are much purer and much more holy than that of the internet. And so it's just this really interesting dynamic of, well, yeah, God hears me all the time, but what if they retweet it?
Right.
It's really funny to think about and terrifying.
Every word is going to be judged on the last day, and all the secrets of the heart will be brought to light. But what the social media phenomenon does is it immanentizes the eschaton of judgment.
Yeah, right? You said the phrase. Excellent.
It brings that final judgment wherein everything is made known to all into our life here and now.
Yeah.
And that is a fearful thing which makes us cry out for mercy, right? Which is the kind of quality which is absent within this sort of judgment.
Yeah.
So it does, I think, for us here and now, in one sense, what nuclear weapons did for previous generations.
Yeah. Yeah, when you said it goes nuclear, I mean, really, that's what I thought of. This is, you know, living, I don't know what it was like to live in fear of the bomb in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s, but, you know, fear the retweet by somebody on the internet, or fear of the sharing, or fear, like my wife's talked about it, like mom blogs, that woman who gets a photo of that one moment she leaves the car for a minute and her kids are there, or she steps away for two, you know, that one awkward, I slipped up mom moment that gets shared on the internet and forever you are shamed as the worst mom in the world. Everybody has that fear now in some dimension, in some way. And it's, yeah. But as you said earlier, your earlier note. Oh, Alistair, you go for it.
I think we need to be aware of the degree to which these almost serve an instinctive conformity. I think of many of the categories that are used: phobia, shaming, tone policing, check your privilege, mansplaining, whatever it is. So many of these things are pre-packaged concepts that demand very little thought of the person who actually uses them. And so it's a very rough and ready-to-go form of criticism on anything that anyone says without actually demanding any stepping back and reflecting upon what is being argued. I think also that it's important to recognize the degree to which these things are active on a larger level, not just on the internet. One of the things I was thinking about recently was Paul Holloway's letter to the editor about N.T. Wright, where he almost talks about N.T. Wright as having little scholarly credentials, and connects that in part to his being against LGBT rights and speaking out on theological issues on that front. And I think this is something that we'll increasingly engage with. It's very easy to say that these things online don't hurt us, but they will hurt us in the future as we are marginalized from certain academic positions, certain positions in the workplace, whatever it is, because we hold views that are not the right views. And on that front, right, I think we need to develop the sense of nerve that Matt talks about, and self-definition, that we do not define ourselves by what other people think of us, and we are prepared to offend modern orthodoxies when that is appropriate. We're not just instinctive contrarians who do it just for the sake of it, but when it's proper, we will do it, and we will have the nerve to do it.
Well, on that note, that seems like a strong word to wrap up on here. As always, there's more threads to follow, but we thank you for listening with us today. And we look forward to some more episodes to come. As always, if you enjoyed the episode, feel free to share it. Feel free to go to iTunes and rate and review us if you enjoyed it. Otherwise, you know, don't waste your time. With that, have a good day.